folks, you may have heard in the most recent legislative session, a bill is passed to eliminate three judgeships on the criminal district court for the parish of Orleans. And we spent a little time yesterday talking with Raphael Goyeneche about the possible implications of same. And joining us today is Jesse Manley, Interim Executive Director of Court Watch NOLA, the folks that spent a lot of time in the sections of court watching the operations. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't we just start off this way, your reaction to this bill that passed?
Yeah, I think it's really disappointing. I think it's going to have a negative effect on the operation of the court and also just the, you know, the confidence that the people in the city have in the system. I'm really disappointed to see that it turned into a political action rather than something that was focused on efficiency or the operation of the court. And we have fewer people to do the same amount of work. I think it's going to increase backlogs and it's going to take longer for crime victims to get justice and defendants who are waiting in jail to get their day in court.
You guys spend a lot of time in the courts watching. What is your appreciation for what you're seeing? Because when you look at some of the statistics as it relates to the throughput, the number of cases that are completed in less than a year and less than 18 months or less than 24 months, there seems to be a pretty wide delta between the courts. What are your observations relative to that and maybe why?
Yeah, so the way that we collect data, we don't necessarily see the case resolutions. We don't see it all the way through. So we have court watchers that are sitting there in court each day and counting things like continuances on the cases that we do see. So last year we saw about 3,000 cases. And so we did track continuances and we've overall seen a reduction in the number of continuances. There is a variety of reasons why continuances happen, and our most recent report actually addressed some of this. The judges, I think, get most of the blame for continuances, and I think they do have a big part to play, but this is it's a wide system, and a lot of people contribute to continuances. So in the 3,000 cases that we saw, the judges were about 11%. Or 11% of the cases, the continuances were attributable to the judges, but also, you know, 10% were attributable to prosecution. Around 9% was the defense attorneys. The defendant not coming to court was a couple of percent. So the judges definitely have a role in it, but they're not the only people responsible. And it's a very complicated system. And, you know, there are a lot of things that could break down.
Do you find that there are some sections of court that have a disproportionate number of continuances as opposed to others?
Absolutely. So we saw that Section J had the highest number of continuances.
That was Judge Derbigny, who actually ended up resigning from the bench as a result of an investigation, right, as to his inability, his unwillingness to show up in court, right?
That is correct. He did step down. We saw that Judge Ziblich, who sat ad hoc, came in and made a lot of progress in chipping away at that backlog. We did see fewer continuances there in that section after Judge Durbany, after Judge Ziblich took over.
Yeah. Were there any other courts that you saw that had above average or more than the average in continuances?
Yeah, so the next highest that we saw was Section I, which was Judge Roche. Then there's a band where everybody is in around the same level. There are some that are exceptionally low. So Judge Davalier, Judge Campbell, Judge Burris had a noteworthy low number of continuances in the cases that we observed. But we do like to provide the caveat is that, you know, we don't see everything. We only see what our court watchers are in there for. So we saw 3,000 cases. That's a lot, but it's not the total number. So some of the judges structure their dockets a little bit differently. So we may, you know, have seen a judge that just did a lot of continuances on the day that we're in there because they had to reset for a trial and they had to move a bunch of cases down. So for the most part, you know, we had a couple that were on the low side and a couple that were on the high side. But there's a big band in the middle where everybody's around the same.
I hear from a lot of lawyers that if you go to that court on a Friday, you can shoot a shotgun through that court and not hit anybody. True or no?
I think that is definitely the lowest activity day. And there are.
It's okay. You can be brutally honest. I mean, this is part of the problem, right? I mean, you know, when you talk about the preservation of rights for victims and the preservation of rights for the criminal defendants themselves, I mean, this is a 5-day court, right? I mean,
it is.
We really can't afford to take a day out of the week and have nothing going on down there, can we?
I do think it is a little suspicious that that Friday is such a low activity day. I don't think that's true for every single court. So, right. You know, I would say on a typical Friday, we usually see, I would say, 8 or 9 of the twelve sections of CDC that are open. Magistrate court is always open, so they still do their two sessions on Friday. But you know, there are, I think, reasons why the judges set their dockets up that way. You know, trials are heavy on Mondays and Tuesdays, and then, you know, they leave space and the rest of it. So I'm not a judge.
But Jesse, isn't that the point? I mean, at some point in time, I'm not suggesting y'all, you're a not-for-profit organization trying to do good work in order to keep the public informed. But somebody ought to be monitoring what's actually happening here, right? I mean, my suspicion is that we're setting up our week around our lifestyle. Well, your lifestyle is supposed to be set around a 5-day work week. You know, just because you're an elected judge, you're not the center of any universe. You're expected to be at that court 5 days a week, minimum of 8 hours a day, I would hope. I mean, I served as a public servant. I was there every day. I mean, you know, took very little sick leave, was very rarely sick, you know, rarely missed work. I mean, I just felt that it was my obligation to be there. I mean, I get the sense, and this, I'm not in that court. I don't know, but I hear from attorneys every day, frustrated, you know, about continuances, the not showing up on time, the docket set for 9 o'clock and they come walking in at 10:45. It's like, what's going on here?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely agree. The Friday issue is, you know, I'm not a judge. I can't speak to why they don't set up their dockets heavily on Friday. But you know, it's something that we could definitely look into. We are very, very concerned about, like you said, the number of continuances, like whether court starts on time. That's very important to public, to members of the public. You know, when there's a disparity in the power, like if you walk into court late as a defendant, the judge can throw you in jail. What happens if the judge shows up late? We know there are a lot of really good reasons why judges may not be able to start court at their scheduled time. They might be signing warrants. They might be taking important meetings. One of the things that we've continually encouraged judges to do is just to communicate with the public. We know that they do a lot of things behind the scenes that the public doesn't understand. And if they're forthcoming with the public, I think they'd be surprised at how forgiving people are. If you come out and you say, like, hey, I'm sorry, we're starting 20 minutes late today. I was signing a warrant. People get that. And they know it's not a sign of disrespect that, like, yeah, I just decided to roll in here. And so that's one of the things we've always asked for the judges to be, is just more transparent and more communicative with the public. The more people understand what judges do and the challenges they have, the more trust they're going to have in the system and the more satisfied they're going to be with the outcomes.
Yeah. You know, I work down there in that courthouse, so I have some experience with it. In my view, one of the greatest judges ever down there, Dennis Waldron, would walk into court every morning, take the bench at 8:30, and announce that he's there and announce who wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And yep. It was compelling, right?
That I've always appreciated most about Judge Waldron is that when somebody appeared in his court, when they were subpoenaed, he would thank them for coming because he would say, I know you made a decision today. You could have not come. And I appreciate the fact that you showed up like I asked you to. And, you know, just that small measure of respect, I think, went so far to bridging the gap between that power imbalance. And, I saw the way that people responded when Judge Waldron did that. And, you know, I think it's something I would encourage all of the judges to really consider doing.
Absolutely. Even though it is their obligation, I get it. Mm-hmm. I think you and I are in the same position on this. I don't really like the way that this came down, right? And I don't think much of anybody does. I don't know that I can argue with the stats and whether or not there should be less. I mean, when I think about having, I remember in the 90s where we had the worst criminal violation years in the history of the city and the history of Jefferson Parish. I was working in JP at the time, but I always stayed current with what the crime picture was throughout the metropolitan area. The throughput in the 90s through that court system was absolutely incredible. And it needed to be because the challenges were great. But we had judges, Judge Frank Shea would have a judge trial and a jury trial going on at the same time. And, wheeling people in and out, making sure, didn't give you a lot of continuances. We had Judge Al Ozer who pre-tried everything. I mean, in advance, they knew. Have you contacted your witnesses? Are they going to be here? Because when we go, we're gone. There's no excuse come Tuesday of next week when this thing is set for trial. You know, and they'd be in his office Thursday. And he'd read them the Riot Act, where we were doing the things to make sure that we had the throughput. Again, when I talk to these lawyers today, I don't hear that. It's kind of catch as catch can, and some judges do it, some don't. But when you look at some of these wide disparities and you hear these anecdotal stories, for me, it's evidence that we're not clicking on all cylinders. And, and I fault the bar, everybody plays a role. And I agree with the way you summed that up to begin with. Everyone plays a role and everyone has to step up and do the right thing here. Otherwise, we have more crime victims, right? We have we have more degrading behavior in our communities. We struggle more. We're losing population. We need to gain population if we're going to survive. And it's so intrinsically linked to this system. It's scary when the system is not clicking on all cylinders. And I don't know about you,
I agree with you.
But let me ask you this question, because I've made this observation. I don't mean to monopolize this, but I haven't had many chances to speak with you. And I have a lot of respect for y'all's organization. How does a court allow a judge to, like Judge Durbingy, who basically didn't show up for almost a year to work? I can't square that up in my mind. I mean, if I were a peer judge, I would have had to have said something. I mean, you just can't have the violation of people's rights, happening like that to the degree of that without anybody saying anything. I mean, it was like mind-numbing to me.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to comment on, what I'm going to call like insider baseball there without me actually being in, the en banc. We definitely noticed that from where we can make observations that Section J was not as efficient as some of the other sections. Even that, I think is complicated. Like I have anecdotally heard that there are some reasons for why, not as many plea deals were offered in his section as other sections, which would have increased efficiency. So, things are hard to really, get a complete picture unless you have like whistleblowers who are, you know, willing to come forward and talk about some of the behind the scenes stuff. But I know that, you know, many of the judges that I have talked to, you know, work really, really hard, and they're trying their best, and
thankfully,
they're listening to input from us and from, you know, MCC about things that we are seeing that they could do better and are trying to improve their efficiency and, you know, make it not only efficiency. It's one of the things I like to point out. We don't necessarily want the fastest system. We want the system that gets it right. And getting a case to trial and resolution is definitely an important part of justice for crime survivors and also defendants. You know, we think about people who are sitting in jail that couldn't make bond, that are waiting for their chance to win their freedom and get out of jail. But we also have to grapple with a history of like wrongful convictions in this city and, you know, just moving as fast as we can and saying like, well, sorry, your witness didn't show up, but, you know, like we're moving on is not necessarily how we get justice. There's a middle ground where we're taking all of the things that need to be considered into you know, into the picture and then finding the right outcome. And so I think it is definitely fair to say that some of the things have not been as efficient, but we also don't want to be completely focused on just how fast it is, because that's how we send people to Angola that don't deserve to be there.
Well, I would humbly disagree with you on a number of different fronts, but that's an argument for another day. I mean, the reality is the burden is on the state, and the defense knows that the longer that they can string these cases out, the less likely that the list of witnesses that the state has on their witness list will show up. And, you know, time, the old adage of time kills all deals, well, time kills most cases. And, you know, and everybody knows it. And the game is played each and every day. The defense does not have to prove their innocence. The state has to prove their guilt. Mm-hmm. And so the balance of interest as to whether or not defense witnesses are there or not, whether it's a character witness or not, you know, there's a utility of these witnesses. And the fact of the matter is that when you set the rules in the court and everyone understands the expectations, you compel people to work twice as hard to meet that expectation because they know what the downstream implications are going to be. And as a lawyer, you don't want to get sued for malpractice if you're not putting in the effort to make sure that your witnesses are there. You end up engaging in covering the proverbial derriere and making sure that you make the contacts and everything else. But unless there's a compulsion or a judge that's going to compel certain human behavior to happen inside their court, guess what? You set low expectations. What do you get, Jesse?
you get poor results. I mean,
you get poor results.
I absolutely agree with you. But we're not talking about like inefficiency on both sides. I think both prosecution, like our public defender's office and the DA's office, are under resourced right now. And so we need improvement on both sides because both sides are contributing. Like when we look at our continuance data, they're within about 1% of each other as the number of continuances that are given to each side. And there's also about 5% that are joint continuances. So, you know, both of them need to do better, and the judges absolutely have a role in demanding better outcomes from them. But we're not seeing like that a huge disparity and like they're all coming from one side. We need better work from everyone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's why I said it's not just the judges, the members of the bar, the Bar Association, the Supreme Court. In my view, everybody needs to wake up because historically, and I know that y'all recognize this, this system has underperformed for decades and is killing the community. Whether they're willing to stand up and say it, I'll say it because it's the truth. And unless we start acting like a system and we're not designing how we're going to conduct our court around our personal lifestyle, nothing's going to change. Nothing, literally nothing there. You know, and it's a shame, but there ought to be a standard that's set by somebody independent of the court that we can hold these individuals accountable to. Because it's just frustrating otherwise. As always, Jesse Manley, Interim Executive Director of Court Watch, NOLA, really appreciate your organization and appreciate you joining us today. Thank you for your time and your insight, and best of luck to you.
Yeah, thank you, Noel.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We've talked about this subject matter quite a bit, and even most recently, we spoke about the crime lab and the DNA lab and the utility of SAME as being one of the most important tools for law enforcement in helping investigate crimes within their community. And joining us this morning is Leslie Harris, councilwoman for the New Orleans City Council, as well as Nick Gernon, the deputy superintendent with NOPD. Folks, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So, Leslie, we'll start with you. We continue to move forward. I know you've been taking a leadership position. You've been out front on this issue with the DNA lab in particular and the crime lab as well. If you would, an update as to where we stand at the present time.
Sure. So right now we've cleared essentially the backlog of major crime kits that were sitting at the state lab by outsourcing. And what we did was the past council dedicated $3 million to clearing that backlog along with state money through Representative Landry and then Vice President Moreno. So we've dedicated about $4.3 million on clearing that backlog. And that's where we are right now. But that $3 million of city money has been exhausted, and the $1.3 should get us through the end of 2026. That's why it's so important that we get our own DNA lab up and running.
And Nick, I know most recently there was some reporting of some troubles with the construction of the crime lab building. More importantly, I think the floor that maybe the DNA lab is going to be hosting on. What are your concerns relative to that? And do we have a remedial plan in place to address same?
Yeah, so we know that when we built that lab, we needed to spend that FEMA money or we would have likely lost it. So there was a decision, conscious decision made by the last administration to move forward with getting a building up. But we have since brought in a forensic architectural firm who has indicated to us that we're going to need to do some renovations to that floor to get it in line with our current standards and practices for a DNA lab. And we are currently working with our council and with the administration to, you know, work towards finding funds for that, because this really is a three-legged stool. This is personnel, this is equipment, and this is the facilities itself. And through Councilmember Harris's work, we now think that we have all these slots needed for personnel. We need to hire them, but at least they're allocated. And our next big lift is to make sure that the facilities are in the proper order.
Yeah, Leslie, I'm sure you know more about DNA than you ever cared to know about DNA, but... But the reality is, and I think both of you could talk about this, getting accredited in the DNA world is not an easy task.
It isn't. And that's exactly what Nick just said. We need to make sure that we are staffed up properly and get that staff trained. Dr. Shamika Kelly is an expert in this, and she's the one who's heading the charge. And so I'm really taking my cues from her as to what staffing we need and then what we need to do as far as upgrading our facilities. The good part about the facilities is that they're located in District B, as are many municipal buildings. And so there's some capital outlay funding that I have that can go towards getting the DNA lab up and running.
Yeah. And Nick, I guess y'all are still utilizing the state police lab. Are y'all utilizing independent labs for DNA testing as well or no?
Both. So we send up all of our evidence, sexual assault kits, bulk evidence, all the various things that need DNA testing to the state police. They screen it and decide whether to outsource it, which is what the majority of what they're doing is, through this $4.3 million that the councilwoman got us a few years ago, or if it is something that is a priority need, you know, a very emergent case, they'll keep it in-house and test it faster and get it back to us faster. But the majority of our things are going through state police for initial screening and serology and then outsourced to outside labs, which brings its own challenges.
And, you know, it's if you would, Nick, for the benefit of the listening audience, DNA plays a real important role, not only in ruling people in, but ruling people out, right?
Absolutely. And look, we started seeing, 10, 15 years ago, all of these exoneration cases, and many, many of them were based on DNA evidence. So our juries, I think, are smart enough to know that they're going to want more than just an eyewitness identification. They're going to want to see evidence. And our gold standard is DNA, followed closely by digital forensics, as you know. But DNA is what juries are looking for when they're saying, I want to see some physical evidence there. We still use tried and true fingerprints. We still use other pieces of physical evidence, ballistics, narcotics testing. But when the opportunity to test DNA presents itself, a jury wants to know, what did you test and what did it result? What did it tell you?
But you have to admit, you guys aren't able to get the DNA out of the air, right? Just kidding. Because the public's expectations sometimes as to DNA in a collection is same. It is not that much greater proficiency than a fingerprint, quite frankly, right?
Correct. But 30 years ago, we could only test a big pool of blood, and now we're testing touch DNA on a regular basis, and we are able to get the cells out of, if somebody reaches into your back pocket to steal your wallet and you're wearing certain materials, there's a good opportunity for that person to deposit their DNA in your back pocket. So we know that the technology is getting better and better. The technology of 2005 when we lost our lab is obviously exponentially better than it was when we last had a DNA lab. So we're making sure that we are supplying and training the lab of 2026 and the 2030s, not the lab of 2005.
The other areas of the crime lab, will they be able to move into the new crime lab building, or have they moved into the new crime lab
building? Oh, they're
there.
Yep, they're there, okay, and they were all recently fully accredited. So for years, we had partial accreditation. When I was at the lab, we had accreditation in advanced forensics, not including DNA, ballistics, firearms. Now we have a full accreditation in every discipline, including, and you'll appreciate this, the management system, which identifies risk within the lab, is also fully accredited by the National Accreditation Board. And our next step is to now build a DNA lab, write up the policies, develop the procedures, properly staff it, and then get the FBI and the National Accreditation Board accreditations that we need to be able to supply evidence to trial.
Yeah, very important tool. Leslie, to you, obviously we all know about the financial challenges of the city. When it comes to what may be the additional dollars necessary to get this DNA lab up and running to the fullest extent, what is the appetite of your fellow members on the council?
I think that they understand the importance of getting this lab up and running. I think by their vote on making sure that we could hire up the personnel, they are showing their willingness to go forward with the lab. And look, the $9 million that it's going to take to refit this lab, I think, can come out of bond dollars and some other things that will not touch our general fund balance. So I think there's a really good opportunity to get us up and running. The goal is by 2027. That horizon may be extended, but I do think that within the next 2 years, we will have a working DNA lab. And get this. At a cost that's less than what we're spending to outsource, and plus we can take in other agencies' DNA at a cost benefit to us, so we can actually take in, charge people for DNA testing. And so it can be a center of getting some cash in the door.
And the beauty of having it is when you control it, you make things happen. You're not relying on the third party, right?
That's correct. And we also have to take into consideration the fees that are charged by the people testing the DNA to come in and testify. So if we have our personnel who are testing the DNA, they can just cross the street to criminal court, testify, and there's no associated fee with that. I mean, we're spending up to $15,000 on getting a witness in to talk about the DNA results. That cost will be eliminated once we get staffed and up and running.
And I'm sure that's impacted the efficiency of the court, too. You know, I just had Jesse Manley on from Court Watch NOLA talking about the reduction of the three judgeships in criminal district court, which really begs of, I think, a behavioral change in the other courts to make sure that they continue to work on and improve the throughput, because it's all about throughput. I mean, it's how you reduce your cost in housing the impact criminals into jail, and it's how you selectively incapacitate the impact criminals quicker, get them to the penitentiary, and that's why you're able to see these reductions that NOPD has been enjoying for a long period of time. It's been a great trend. Hopefully we can continue it.
Yeah, and look, fundamentally what we're trying to do with this is get victims of crime their day in court, to get the accused their day in court. And so if there's some exoneration that happens because of the DNA evidence, I think that's a positive. If someone is going to jail for the rest of their lives because they harm somebody, I think that's important too. So beyond the cost benefit of getting our own DNA lab up and running, I think that there's also a victim benefit of getting this up and running.
Yeah. Nick, final thoughts?
I just really appreciate Councilmember Harris really sticking with this. We had a lot of challenges that we had to face to get these staffing positions filled, and now we're on the road there, and I appreciate her being a partner and moving this whole situation forward.
Thank you.
Leslie, yours?
No, I'm appreciative of NOPD and their efforts, and I'm looking forward to seeing what we can do in the future.
Absolutely. Sounds like a great partnership. Thank you all so much for joining us this morning, Councilwoman Leslie Harris and Nick Gernon, Deputy Superintendent with NOPD. Continued success on this endeavor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. At 12:30, we're going to go to No Filter Friday open line. So if you have something you want to talk about, we'll do that at 12:30. Let's go to Woods right now. Woods, you're on. What say you?
My comment about the reduction of judges. Would it cost more to keep inmates in jail, food, clothes, shelter, recreation, medicine? Which would be cheaper? Keeping the judges or keeping the inmates in jail? If this is the thing about saving money.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because you have two different folks that are responsible. In one case, it's the city, right, of the pretrial inmates in jail. And in the other case, the courts, the state is contributing dollars for those positions. So it's not the same paymaster. But be that as it may, I think. Go ahead.
What you told me is still public money.
Oh, sure. Yes, sir. What I'm just saying is the interests don't align. The interests of the two parties don't align.
Right. But what would be the most cost saving?
Well, we don't know because we don't know the impact until the three judgeships are no longer there. And that's why I have been trying to point out the obvious. If I were on that court, I could tell you that I would be having a meeting right now with the DA, the sheriff, the members of the court, to anticipate the loss of three judges and to develop a plan to see how we can all become more efficient to make up the difference. Because as it stands right now with the open cases that are in these courts, felony and misdemeanor pending cases, when three judges are lost, each of the other judges, the nine judges, will end up with 53 more cases. There's a total of 477 cases at the present time in the three sections that are going to come to an end. So 53 more cases. I mean, that's a relatively large number, but it's not one, I don't think, that's not manageable. But things don't just happen, Woods, and I'm sure you recognize that. You got to make it happen. You got to plan for it. You got to develop a strategy. You got to figure out everybody's going to have to do more. That's what you do when when the challenges are there, whether you're in the private sector or the public sector, to overcome those challenges, you got to do more.
Yeah,
agree?
Yeah, I agree, but it's like two sides to every story. What is the purpose? The cost saving or efficiency?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, I get your point. You're right.
I don't want to take up too much of your time, but that's just something that came to my mind.
Okay. No, absolutely. Great observations. Yeah, great observations, Woods. Great comments. I mean, these are all things that you would take into consideration typically before making this kind of decision. I go back to the court has no one to blame but themselves. I mean, they've had every opportunity to prove to the public, to everyone involved, to the legislature, that they were willing to stand up, do the right thing, get the throughput, manage themselves in an appropriate fashion, set up court schedules that make sense for the system, not your lifestyle. You are a public servant. You're not the center of the universe. And if that means you got to do more, you do more. I mean, when the public calls on you to do things, I know in my world, it was going to a murder scene, going here, going there, coming back from vacations, you know, because a hurricane was going on. Those are the sacrifices that you make. Because, you know, the public can vote you in or vote you out. Unfortunately, we've had a very apathetic public that are not clued in to these elections. Now, you're going to have an opportunity to shape the course of the court in a big way in the fall. You know, and when we didn't take the LIFO method here of the last in, first out, and we actually jumped over other judges in order to save Judge Roche, obviously that smacks of a political deal. And I wish the people that involved themselves in that process that got to that, because I could promise you one thing, Honorable Jane Morris, the senator from North Louisiana who's responsible for all this, he doesn't know any of these people. He didn't save that person on his own volition. There's somebody asking him to break with what the understanding of the public was of last in, first out. Now, I call those people that are not willing to stand up, call into this show, call into any show, call the NOLA.com, I don't care. If you don't stand up and take ownership of it, you're a coward. And you're misleading the public. And the truth be told is that the public's going to have an opportunity to send a message to you and any other coward that was involved in this process that they're not willing to accept it. And I hope they do. Because unless and until the public reacts in that fashion, nothing is going to change. We'll be right back.